Hello, everybody. Just a very quick one about Instagram. If you're on it, Meta, the parent company, is reducing the number of political posts visible to users on their feed. This is a real thing, not a hoax. So go to your Instagram profile, tap the three horizontal lines in the top right corner to open the settings tab, scroll down to what you see, click on content preferences, open political content, and turn on don't limit political content. That's an option. Otherwise, you won't see almost anything we post because we are deemed political. Please do that now, or you won't even see the posts about our shows, our fun things. So if you want to see Guilty Feminist content and know when we're coming to a place near you or releasing a new podcast, do it now.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, it's Abigailia Shaman, sometimes co-host of Guilty Feminists and winner of Pointless Celebrities, but who's counting? I have some amazing news for you. Global Pillage is coming back, baby. We will be performing Thursday, May 9th, and Monday, June 17th, 7:30 p.m. at King's Place. I am the new host, and we have an amazing panel for you. But what we need is you. We need you, the hive mind, to come to the show. So you can get tickets at kingsplace.co.uk. Remember, the shows are May 9th, June 17th, 7:30 p.m. at King's Place. I'll see you there.
I'm a feminist, but my favorite Famous Five character was George, but I didn't realize she was a girl till I was 8. Fully thought she was a boy. I must have missed the pronouns. Has anyone else got one? Jess?
I'm a feminist, but I love coming to great big bookshops like this because they make me want to read all the books in the world. But I'm a feminist, but my favourite thing about coming today was the chance to have a look and see if there's a calendar of gladiators.
What?
I absolutely would like to kiss every gladiator. And I want there to be a special calendar in here. And there aren't many shops where you buy like those big old calendars anymore with like a picture and the... Yeah.
No, it's true. It's very true. You can't get them anymore because people use their phones as calendars for everything. We don't have watches anymore. We don't have calendars anymore. We don't have...
I do. I still got all my passwords written on a little note in a code.
Do you?
Yeah, I've got early onset old age.
Eliana, do you have an I'm a feminist but for us?
I do. I'm a feminist, but I truly believe that given the chance, I could fix Heathcliff.
I think that's probably correct. I mean, with that hat, absolutely. You'd take one look and he'd be a reformed man.
Okay, I'm a feminist, but I spent the whole of seventh grade with my best mate swooning over Oscar Wilde, thinking that we both wanted to marry a version of Oscar Wilde, and didn't find out he was gay for years later.
I'm a feminist, but up until my first year of university, I thought the feminine mystique was a perfume. It does sound, to be strictly fair to me.
I'm a feminist, but the books that got me into reading finally in my teens wasn't intellectually anything to be proud of. It was the point horrors. Okay, should have started with the gladiators.
Yeah.
I'm a feminist, but most of the feminist books I've ever read was because I watched the film first. Also should have stopped at Feminimisty.
Yeah.
Any more?
I'm a feminist, but I didn't have a problem with the male gaze because I thought it was a question about homosexuality.
That means you're very young. Live from Waterstones, Piccadilly, this spontaneity daily shop presents the Guilty Feminist Book Club with me, Deborah Francis-White, guest co-host Jessica Fosterko, and our very special guests Susie Miller and Eliana Ostro talking about Fear of Flying and Prima Facie. This is The Guilty Feminist, the podcast in which we explore our noble goals as 21st century feminists and the hypocrisies and insecurities which undermine them. Not everybody knows. Some people are here for the book club because they heard about it through Waterstones and they're like...
They haven't learned our catchphrase.
What the fuck is this? Just give us a cheer if you're here because of Waterstones and you don't know what The Guilty Feminist is. Just one person. Okay. So when I say the hypocrisies and insecurities... Which undermine them? I say, which undermine them? I don't know why I said it like that, it's just evolved. And now people tend to join in. Okay, ready? In which we explore our noble goals as 21st century feminists and the hypocrisies and insecurities which undermine them. I'm Deborah Francis-White. With me is Jessica Foster-Q and our incredibly special guests. And we are talking about Fear of Flying and Prima Facie. Yeah. Prima.
Well done.
Prime, as in the best. Yeah. Yes, that's how I have to think about it. Okay, now I'm going to...
Amazon Prima Facie.
Okay. I'll never forget it now. I'll literally never forget it. Hello, 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 and welcome to our very, very first Guilty Feminist Waterstones Book Club. Which we're delighted to say sold out in record time, implying that the Guilty Feminist audience is fizzingly, throbbingly literate. And literary. So, I'm sorry, literate's a low bar, isn't it? literary, sorry, I don't mean to insult you.
I enjoyed it.
I meant, you know, book people, bookish, that at least some guilty feminists don't just listen to their content, they also read it. Unless you did some audiobooking on this one. Just give us a cheer if anyone listened to the audiobook of either of the books we're discussing today. Yeah, I also love an audiobook. I love to be read to. Love it. Especially if it's the author reading it as well, because then I think, well, I know exactly what they mean by this. You know, I can get tone or I can see how they think about the character. Now, we're discussing two books today. One is the incredible Prima Facie by Susie Miller. Who we've got here, I'll do the formal introductions in a bit. It would be good if you were hiding behind a pillar, but yeah, we didn't.
I could burst out.
It's just not that kind of gig. We're in a bookshop if you're listening at home. And so we've just been sitting on the stage and the stage has an amazing Persian rug on it. So we're feeling very fancy. On the third floor of Waterstones Piccadilly, and it's absolutely very lovely, and it's making us feel especially literary, surrounded by books, and literate. It's making us feel so literate.
Literate and literary, and we're mainly surrounded by cookery books, so we're also peckish.
I mean, that's a very Jess Foster-Q thing to say.
And cheese is very much in my eyeline right there every time I try and look at it.
Don't forget to listen to Jess Foster-Q's podcast, Hoovering, all about eating. That's a sideways plug. It's an on-brand plug. Just give us a cheer if you managed to read feminist classic Fear of Flying by Erica Jong. Okay, don't be ashamed. People have gone, oh, I don't want to be the only one. Like, it's like who's done your homework? And there are people in the room going, I thought we all had to do it. No, I didn't. Whatever. I'm cool. Just give us a cheer if you have, for this club or at some time in the past, read feminist classic Erica Jong's Fear of Flying. Woo. Don't put your hands up. Oh, my God, just because we're in a bookshop. If we're in Soho Theatre, you'd be like, woo! But you're here in a bookshop going, shh. So just go, shh, if you read. So some of you have read it, some of you haven't. So, well, to be honest... Is everyone cool with a spoiler or two for Fear of Flying?
Yeah. Some of you are looking at nodding.
Yeah, some of you are looking at me like, I've no intention of reading it. Spoiler away. But hopefully we'll lure you in to read it later. So those are the two books we're discussing tonight because we thought in our book club we would compare and contrast a contemporary book with a feminist classic because it would get us all to read feminist classics. That's clearly not worked. It's going to get us. It's going to get us. Force us to on the stage to read feminist classics, and for you to listen to them, to listen to stuff about them. Okay, all right. I'm going to do our quick intro to the guests. Our first guest today is a Jewish female writer-director whose play Anything with a Pulse transferred from the Edinburgh Fringe for two sell-out London runs. She also recently launched a jewellery company called Siren with 10% of its profits going to the charity Womanity. And she is currently developing multiple projects for television. Put your hands together and make incredible Guilty Feminist Book Club woohooing noises for Eliana Ostro! My co-pilot today is a Guilty Feminist absolute ultra favourite. She is also an incredible comedian and writer. But what you didn't know, and is relevant for especially one of our books today, is that she has a law degree. She's kept this quiet. She was on track to become a defence barrister, right on theme for Amazon Prima Facie. And, we can't call it that. And what's more, in her degree, she specialised in the law around rape, which is so on theme for Prima Facie. Now, I will say at the front, actually, even before I've said that, clearly after I've said that, does everybody know the themes of Prima Facie? Is anybody thinking, oh God, I just thought this was two books and I wanted in off the street? It was sold out, so I assume you all know. Okay. It is about a defence barrister and a rape trial, and there are also themes of sexual assault in the other book. We will all, of course, be talking about the law. We're not going to be, you know, talking about that the whole time, but I just wanted you all to know, because I don't normally like saying, you know, there are certain words that I just kind of avoid in case people go, oh, but we will have to talk about that today. Just checking in. Everyone happy? Everyone feeling all right? Okay, good. All right. All right. Finally, we are joined by a very special guest. We're very privileged to have an Australian-British playwright, librettist. I might be the first librettist we've ever had on The Guilty Feminist. You don't see many librettists these days. Screenwriter and lawyer. Her plays have been produced in Belfast, Glasgow, Perth, Sydney, and of course the West End and Broadway, where she has won many awards, including, you won an Olivier, didn't you? And the play won a Tony in New York as well on Broadway, which is very exciting. Well, yeah, but that's the play, isn't it? That's Jodie can't win a Tony with no play. So, I mean...
God, it even scans so well. Jodie won a Tony.
She has now... She has now turned her stage smash hit, Prima Facie, into a novel. Please welcome to the stage the author of one of the books we're discussing today. It's the incredible Susie Miller! I'm so thrilled to have you here because we're actually going to be talking about your book.
I know, I'm overwhelmed, actually. It's brilliant.
Well, I was absolutely thrilled that I loved it.
Yeah.
Because I thought, oh, otherwise, you know, it's so much easier to be rude about somebody if they're not there, you know, and you've turned up. So, you know, thank God. Yeah. I really did love it. I mean, I loved the play so much. It was going to be weird if I didn't like the novel, but I feel it's really added and it's just like been such a juicy treat. Just give us a cheer if you've seen the play or read the play. Woo! Yeah, most people. So if you've seen a play, it's just there's so much depth that you didn't get. So it's like finding out all these things about these, you know, these really interesting characters, and especially Tess, the lead character. That's absolutely been wonderful. So we've got two books. I'm going to ask Susie to summarise her own book.
Okay. So Prima Facie is about a young working class woman who is now at the bar and she's worked really hard. She's overcome so many obstacles, including a scholarship to Cambridge. And now she's absolutely like, just making it at the bar, like she's really doing well.
And when you say at the bar, you mean
at the bar as a barrister.
Yeah. When you just say at the bar out of context, it could be
she's just at the bar
from 9 till 5.
Because I also was at the bar during university for a lot of it.
I think a lot of us were. Even the barristers are at the bar now or at the bar then. So she's at the bar. She's a barrister. She's absolutely winging it. She's doing great, winning all her cases, including loads of cases where she's defending alleged perpetrators of sexual assault and rape. And she's really committed to her job. Anyway, then she has a date with a colleague, another barrister, And that date ends up ending up in a rape for her, which is terrible. She goes to the police. She decides to take it to court because she wants to believe the system will work. And spoiler alert, it doesn't.
Mm. And it's really powerful, both in the play and in the novel, around there's like the conviction rate, something like 2%.
It's 1.3%. So that's only the people that actually take it to court, which, of course, one in three women have an experience. Like one in 10 of those will report it to the police. Out of those, very few go to court. And the ones that go to court, there's a 1.3% conviction rate. So something's not working. And I guess that's her point. When she actually is a witness in her own court, mm-hmm. she can actually speak to that because she's been on both sides of the bar table.
And we're going to talk about that and go into depth. We also wanted to talk about Fear of Flying, which is, it was a book that was written in 1972?
73.
Thank you. It was a book that came out in 1973, and at the time it was seen as this massive feminist classic. Because it was a woman writing extremely, it was like almost like the original Fleabag, writing extremely, just evocatively about sex and her own desires and what was going on inside of her. And she wasn't just sitting there coyly, you know, hoping for romance, but that she had this desire. And what's most famous about it is that she says that she wants a zipless fuck. And for her, that means a sexual encounter where there's no lead up, there's no romance, there's just this moment of pure passion where you don't even talk to each other. You just see each other, rip each other's clothes off, have sex and walk away and never speak. And this is obviously a fantasy, but it was a real admission at the time that a woman would want to do that. And, you know, you've got to think it's, you know, it's the early 70s. It's about an erotic poetess called Isadora, should I say poetess? That's like comedienne, isn't it? Really?
Yeah, let's poet.
It's about an erotic poet called Isadora Wing. And the names in this are quite Dickensian because she has a fear of flying, both a literal fear of flying, but also a fear of soaring as herself. She's going to from America to Germany with her husband, Bennett. She's Jewish. It's not very long after the Second World War. She has obviously a lot of very triggering feelings about going to Germany and her time there before. And she falls in love with an Englishman called, in a Dickensian fashion, Adrian Goodlove. Turns out he's not actually that great at all, not at the beginning anyway. But it's really about her finding herself, finding her full self as a woman, and the idea that marriage isn't the be-all and end-all at a time for, you know, second-wave feminism was really exploring those ideas. But I think it was the first book, they said, that where a woman had expressed those desires so obviously and blatantly. There had been books about men's sexual desires. Surprise, surprise. But there hadn't been about women. All right, so those are the two. Would you like to read something,
Yeah,
Susie?
I'm going to read something that's not in the play because I figured if anyone's seen the play, then they won't have. So the book goes into a lot more detail about her life and her family and just where she's come from and what's going on inside her head as well. So this is just a very short read, but just to get you into the mood of what Chancery Lane and the courts are like. There's a shop called Eden Ravenscroft. If anyone's in the law here, you all know it. It's where you buy your wig and gown and all the rest of it. It's very archaic as well. But anyway, I'm going to read from where they go in there. Phoebe waltzes in wearing trainers like I am. We decide to walk to court, talk about the case I'm running, and get in some steps along the way. We walk down Chancery Lane. I need to pick up a barrister collar I ordered. We've all been to Eden Ravenscroft. It's been there forever. This is the major retailer for barristers' wigs, gowns, and collars. It also sells expensive business shirts, men's socks, and judges' attire. The black and gold wig tins that everyone is given as a call to the bar gift are only sold here. They're stamped with the name of the shop with the initials of the barrister printed or engraved on it. Eden Ravenscroft is an institution which connects us all to barristers immemorial. KC wigs and judges' wigs are also made here, the strange symbols of hierarchy and mystique that keep the profession so elite, so expensive, so staged. Up on the shelves lining the highest points of the walls are the large wig tins, the largest of all housing the judges' wigs. One of them has the name of Lord Denning on it. I always look up for it when I enter the store. So many judgments I read at law school had his name in them, and yet here I can be so close to something he would have touched. Although, truth be told, those old judges had people to protect and prepare their judicial robes and wigs, then place them on the revered man. There are only a few women who know the patented way of making the E&R wig. The workshop studio below the store is where they labour, threading and plaiting the hair from horse tails until magically a new headpiece for a barrister or judge emerges. No one knows their secret design or the methodology of these older women who have inherited the protocol through the ages. The law is so much about inheritance, yet this aspect slightly delights me. I remember Johnny when he and Mum came with me for my fitting and I told them about the women downstairs making all the wigs. He was joking about whether they got their revenge on the barristers and judges by spitting in the wigs of those they didn't like. While it wasn't Johnny's intent, I found this idea of the subversion of the patriarchy and all it represents to be intoxicating. And yet, of course, there I was lining up for my own wig.
That's a really amazing piece about the archaic nature, isn't it, of the wig and all, and the gown and everything it represents, and you're entering that. But is it feminism because you're entering the same thing?
Yeah.
What do you think, Jess?
I've got goosebumps. Yeah, it's so funny. Yeah, well, she's worked so hard, as have all the women before her, to be taken seriously in that profession, to be allowed in even, yeah. Let alone to start making up any sort of meaningful numbers comparatively. But then,
definitely.
I mean, it's like a microcosm version of the kind of what feel insurmountable problems within the law in terms of, do you fix it from within or from without?
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think also the fact that there's those older women downstairs making that wig from a sort of secret recipe that's inherited.
Secret recipe.
Yeah, that's basically
the secret the wig recipe, yeah.
But there's something about that, that they're, you know, that's what the women inherited, whereas
that was
the men inherited.
Just the chair, by the way.
So I just wanted to sort of contrast that idea of the women inherit the sort of making of a task to do so that everyone else can be a barrister, whereas like down the ages, like the Lord Dennings and the, well, probably not him actually, because he was a bit more liberal, but they all inherited their wigs and gowns from their fathers who were judges and barristers before them.
There's also an element of it, women at every level are feeding into this archaic system.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's not just at the sort of people coming in at the bar.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it's sort of everywhere. We're all adhering to it.
Yeah,
and those, those small transgressions that build up, and they, I suppose it's like the cicadas that stay with you in any story. But one of the things I think I'll remember, I'm not very good at remembering what happens in books generally or in stories generally, but I remember moments. And when she goes to get her first wig, once she's can afford it, and they strongly implies she should get the tin, and she doesn't because she's got a Tupperware from her mum that she keeps it in, and these days increasingly proudly gets that Tupperware out in court to get her wig out. And I love that.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, there's that lovely scene as well where her mother gives her a blouse that she thinks a lawyer would wear.
Yeah.
And there's so much wonderful stuff about class in that and about those feelings she's got of now she's in some, you know, grand silk shirt that she wouldn't have worn at home, and her mother's given her something that's quite polyester.
100% polyester.
Yes, but she's really grateful for it, and she loves that her mother tries. And but her mother also has mixed feelings and says, you get bad men off.
And I think anyone that's worked as a defence lawyer has had that in droves. I mean, if you've worked as a defence lawyer, you know what I mean, is that you go to dinner parties and or your parents say to you constantly, oh, you're getting all the criminals back out on the street, and you think, kind of miss the point of the justice system. It is actually about innocence until proven guilty.
Mm-hmm.
And in many ways, we've all missed the point of the system. That's all it's about. It's not actually about justice for complainants or victims.
Yeah.
And that is a really deep theme of the book, isn't it? It's about what's a better system, I suppose, because we do want to assume everybody's innocent. We don't want to just go, oh, somebody said something about you, or, you know, we think you've committed a crime, throw away the key.
Yeah.
We do want a system that, you know, and that's what the book's really investigating, is how the system has become something that's been played so that, you know, if you're trying to get someone off, that's your job. You've got to try and get them off as much, even if you know that they're guilty.
Well, you can't know that. I guess you can't know for sure that someone's guilty until they've been through the whole system and a jury of their peers. But the problem is that some of the kind of infrastructure is all decided by men in a way that you can never win in a system like that. Even if the person did it, it's almost an impossible thing to actually convince a jury of. Because women have to prove not only that it happened to them and they weren't consenting, but that the person that did it knew they weren't consenting. Mm-hmm. And they're the only ones that have to give any evidence. The alleged perpetrator doesn't have to say a thing. And so, of course, they're doomed to fail because they're completely undermined by defence lawyers the whole time. And some of the questions just, like, they play into rape myths. The idea of saying, oh, you did this because you regretted having sex with him. And you think, in this day and age when people have sex because women have total autonomy over their sexuality in terms of deciding to or not, that to regret having sex with someone, it seems ludicrous to suggest that you'd go to that much trouble.
Yeah.
You would just go, I won't tell anyone. Like, you know, you're no longer kind of like carrying your virginity around like it's this thing that you have to protect because otherwise your whole reputation's gone.
Yeah. Do they think we're Jane Austen heroines?
I don't know.
I mean, it's absolutely
But they go, you just regretted having sex with him. And you think how is – and but the jury go, yeah, that might be why.
Surely everyone at some point nearly everyone at some point has regretted having sex with somebody. No? Only me. Okay.
100%.
Okay. That that would seem like an extraordinary thing to put yourself through that, knowing that in over 99% of cases, you are going to have to face...
3 years later, you're going to have to do it all, going to be asked questions all the way through.
And but you won't be believed 99% of times.
And the same with saying you're just doing it because you're jealous that he didn't end up with you. And you think, oh, my God, I don't know any woman I know that would go through that just because... They're thinking, I'm going to pay you back for rejecting me.
It plays really into that. Like,
extraordinary.
Yeah. There's still so many like deep kind of sexist assumptions in the way that the idea that there must be something vindictive about it. There's something jealous about it. There's something competitive about it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean.
Yes, we all have disappointment. We all have jealousy. We all have feelings of rejection and attachment. But that would be an extraordinary thing to put yourself through on top of that.
And
if that was what you were feeling.
There's acknowledgement in it in terms of how far even the law on rape has come, like in the sense that if you still, you need to try and hold on to this, the idea of the rule of law, at the same time as trying to make this a law that's prosecutable at all, you know, it nods to the fact that, you know, even a few years before that, you know, submission counted as consent. That's what I when I was doing a law degree. That was the hot topic then.
Like to not fight,
ages
and scream
me. But yeah, I mean that, and that you used to be that if it was your partner doing it, it couldn't be rape. It used to be within marriage.
Yeah.
There was no such thing as rape.
Yeah.
You used to be able to, you know, bring into the case until really recently what she was wearing.
Yeah.
You know, that she was asking for it was a genuine defence.
Sort of, in the book, they sort of allude to, you know, people bringing out underwear
but
and
it,
like,
you still get scared because you know that assumption.
Yeah.
You know, when
going home alone,
it's
so
a bit
sort of
crazy.
I mean, I remember them. I remember when I was a junior lawyer, someone holding up underwear and going, well, look what you were wearing, obviously. And I know every woman in the courtroom will look at each other like, we're all wearing underwear like that. That's not an invitation for anything.
No.
Yeah.
It's just nice underwear.
That's that thing in the book as well about Spanx. Some male barrister.
This is based on something I watched at the Old Bailey, actually.
Really?
Wow. The Old Bailey, the inner London, yeah.
Suggested that the alleged victim had peeled her Spanx off in an inviting and sexy way like that.
And she'd been
rolling down.
She was sort of like crashed out at a party or something after, and they said, well, if she took her Spanx off to sleep overnight, that was definitely invitation.
She took her Spanx off so she could breathe in and out.
You literally couldn't sleep in Spanx.
Obviously the male barrister didn't know that.
No.
And I said to him after, you do realise that if no one would fall asleep with Spanx. You would not get to sleep.
Were there women in the jury for that?
Yeah, and the women in the jury, you could tell I was looking at them going, you're never going to win this case because
everyone
I know those,
knows,
all those 22-year-olds are going, oh, no, you don't sleep in Spanx.
No. That's also, there is no sexy way of removing Spanx. There's no way that could be misconstrued as seductive or not that that would matter. Even if you did manage to do a seductive Spanx striptease, if you then said no, I don't want to have sex with you or I've changed my mind, that it's fucking irrelevant how you took your Spanx off.
Totally.
You could rip them off with Velcro like you were in the full Monty. It wouldn't matter. But yes.
You're just in relief that they're gone.
It's true. It's true. Anyway,
they're
absolutely.
They're probably a like a patriarchal kind of construct as well, the Spanx themselves.
Yes. Well, they like, definitely are. Yeah, they're basically the corset again. I am a feminist and I refuse to wear Spanx on that basis, except with two dresses. There's just two. I'm a feminist,
but I got sent a pair of Spanx by a feminist underwear company to make a video to say, aren't these ridiculous? And I've kept them and worn them to every single wedding ever since.
I got invited to the Golden Globes once and wore them, but took them off in the bathroom because I couldn't eat.
Yeah.
Oh, that's the worst. I really don't. I don't believe in them. I just think. Look. I'd just rather wear another dress. I can't be doing with it anymore. I have done it and it's just not going to be part of my life anymore. I eschew them. To sort of get back to your book, which is incredible. I thought it would be fun if we all talked about just one moment in the book or theme. Mm. We will come to you for questions as well because we know you'll have questions. But is there a moment in the book or a theme or a character or a style of writing or anything that particularly you would like to talk about as a jumping off point? Either you, Jess or Eliana?
Sure. Well, this is a very small moment. I would say there are a lot, you know, much larger themes in terms of the ending, which I don't want to spoil, but basically the ending sort of solves the legal issues with rape, and I think is the most unbelievable ending for a book. But just a small moment of when the protagonist comes home to her mum and she's got her a Fanta and she's just like helping with the cooking, and the mum's like, oh, it's not diet Fanta or something. And she's like, oh, it's not sugar free. And she's like, the daughter's just like, ugh. And the son is sort of just around not helping. And I think I'm from a Jewish family, that it is something you see quite a lot where it's, you know, it's very easy to make a mistake as a woman, and the man sort of has to do so little to not be seen as a failure.
And he'd just been in a major fight.
He literally just punched someone in the face.
So the daughter's criticised for not getting the right kind of Fanta, but she's helping with the meal.
Yeah.
And the son has just been involved in a big fight,
yeah,
but she's the one that's criticised.
Also, that there's so much colour in that scene. Like, it's you can really see it. And that which she goes overboard with gratitude for this horrible shirt. But she loves how her mum's reacting to how grateful she is and how much well she's pretending she loves this shirt. And I love it that when the brother comes in, having had his fight and everything, like immediately, like, look at you and your fancy shirt. It was like, oh no,
and
she
her inner monologue
win.
Is like, I want to be like, this isn't shirt. My shirt.
Yeah.
But she's like, I can't upset mum, but like, you know.
Yeah,
I'm getting the drinks slightly wrong. Yeah. Such a good point, yeah.
I do think both the play and the book are very intersectional in that way, because it's not just about gender, it's about class. Mm. And it's not trite. There's a lovely thing where when she is at, is she at bar school or she's at uni?
She's at Cambridge.
She's at Cambridge and she's doing her law degree, and the lecturer says, or the professor says, one in three of you will not make it. And she's feeling really working class, and like they're all from posh schools and they're all from posh families. They're all supported and they don't have to have a day job and all of that sort of stuff. And she assumes that the girl next to her went to public school or private school, as you'd say in Australia. And then that girl becomes her close friend.
Yeah, and I think one of the things is, and actually that was in the play as well, so it's not, but it's stretched out a bit in the book in terms of explaining why she thinks that. And I think that that's it, isn't it? Like when you come from the opposite side of everyone else, you assume certain things. And one of the things that the dean is actually making a point about is, like in law, never assume you're telling yourself the truth. Like never trust your instincts, only your legal qualification, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And your legal instincts are very different to your human instincts. So as a defence barrister, you can't trust your instincts about whether they did it or not. You can only trust your legal instincts as whether this is a story that can be heard by the court and give them the opportunity of seeing whether there's any reasonable doubt.
Yeah.
And or not, or whether there's not reasonable doubt as well. So in a way, she's actually giving that first legal lesson. But one of the things that Tess takes away from that is that, you know, she looks at this friend who she has an instinct that will never be her friend. Well, sorry, this young woman who will never be her friend, but that ends up being her closest friend. And I think that, you know, it works in reverse. I know that having not gone to those schools, that when I went to law school, I was a bit like, oh, they all went to those schools. They're not going to be my friends. And, of course, some of them became my closest friends, mm-hmm, because, you know, that they just had a different life experience to me, but it doesn't mean they're not they're not equipped with some great humanity as well.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, we're all quick to judge based on somebody's background in the same way that people were quick to judge me, I'm sure. But you know, you find your friends because they have other similarities to you. But I guess I was playing on the idea that your instincts can be wrong, and actually mm-hmm. the Dean was right. Her instincts were wrong because Mia ends up, and the book goes into great detail about her and Mia and their relationship. Mm. And you see that Mia feels that she's at law school to please her family and that she doesn't want to be there.
Mm.
So, you know, like all the assumptions she made about Mia were quite wrong. She wanted to be somewhere entirely different.
Yes, the idea of assumptions, and especially if you are from a different class or a different ethnicity or different, you know, from the dominant group,
yeah.
A different, or, you know, there'd be lots of women there, but the law is made for and by men. Mm-hmm. And so you're coming in at some kind of a disadvantage, and it's really easy mm-hmm. to make assumptions. And then the book goes on to sort of show that the assumptions reflected back on her when she is the victim of a crime.
That's the friend that really stands by.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. What was it that stuck out to you most, Jess?
Do you know what? Maybe it's good with that because Mia is proven to be such an extraordinary and devoted friend. But I wanted to talk about Alice.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Who's a colleague who Tess is friendly with, but whose behaviour is adversarial a lot of the time. There's a lot of questioning. You know, in the beginning, she questions Tess's choices in a way that make you steer you where it's going and make you go, yeah. And she's thinking with her instincts. But the thing is, you've got this strange status imbalance where, or play, I'd say, where it's so obvious that Alice is from this world, hasn't had to learn what brand of shoes to get, what sort of voice to do, what, you know, has privileged, but is nowhere near as good a lawyer and knows it. And yeah. there's a kindness, they're tactile, like, no, it's not tactile, tactful in how they're, there's a real kindness in how they work together. They're colleagues and there's definitely a friendliness. And how Alice reacts to the rape, oh, my God, I felt as furious with her as I did with him. Yeah. There are cartoon awful responses by other people in it who are sort of outwardly kind of vicious and cruel and self-serving or ambitious and heartless, whereas Alice desperately attempts some kind of neutrality that I found more emotive and offensive because... Yeah. It's the sort of conversation I can imagine having yeah. with a family member. Do you know what I mean? Where you're yeah. like, ah! And yeah. and it feels like it really represents, again, like another way of representing that, the neutrality that the law tries to bring to something where actually in this case, we can't get fairness with yeah. that kind of just pure logic lens put through
yeah.
this. We have to, at some point, trust between two people's stories
yeah.
the woman.
Yeah, and I think also, I mean, I'm really glad you raised that about Alice because one of the things I really noticed in the law is, and I worked in human rights and defence, all these people that were so loud about human rights and so prepared to sort of like, you know, call out the law, but then if they had to stand up and stand for someone that wasn't part of the power structure, there was a little lacking of courage there and I really noticed that just in general that, you know, I would say, well, it's, you know, like, why are we doing X rather than Y? And someone who would have agreed with me privately wasn't prepared to put their hand up in front of a whole bunch of senior counsel. And you go, oh, I forget they understand. I don't know what you'd learn at private schools because I didn't go to one, but they understand the dynamic that you're taking a risk that you don't quite understand yourself when you're someone that's not from the kind of majority. Mm-hmm. And so I think Alice realised that to stand with Tess was to actually lose a bit more power that she'd, and she'd already lost so much.
Mm.
And that, you know, she sort of identified Julian as her friend and she didn't want to have to choose between people. And it's like when people get divorced.
Yeah.
You know, that sense of going, I don't want to choose, don't make me. Mm. But eventually someone makes you or something horrible. Mm. But, you know, like I feel like with her it was different. It was actually a moral position and she'd sprouted so much about that. But then when it came to her world, she wasn't as able to stand up and be counted in a way. And that really let really let Tess.
It was like very much moral convenience. Whenever it suited her, she would sort of be like,
but isn't it wrong to go and do that?
Yeah. And then straight away when push comes to shove, she won't
She's
stand
looking
by
after
her.
Herself. Yeah.
I have a friend who recently told me about 20 years ago, she and her boyfriend at the time were involved in some scuffle on the street. A guy came out, thought they were, someone had been messing with his car, assumed it was them because they were coming home and had stopped near the car. And he was attacking them, and eventually her boyfriend punched him because he wouldn't, you know, he was being aggressive, and there was a scuffle. And they were both accused of something. You know, they're working class people. And the barrister said to her, have you been to university? And she said, yes, I have. And she said, I didn't finish though. He said, doesn't matter, don't say that. Don't say you haven't finished. He said, as long as you've been to university, I can get you off. And I was like, oh my God, is this how it goes? You know? And she said, I only did 1 year and I dropped out. But she was like, it was enough for him to go, this university educated young woman, and it's the story we tell. I saw something recently about, and I don't know the details, so maybe I shouldn't even mention it, but there was someone, an Oxbridge young woman who'd stabbed her boyfriend, but she got off completely because they said, well, she's too intelligent to go to jail. And we are still, this is not 20 years ago, this is now. And And like the prejudice that we have about the kinds of people who should and shouldn't go to prison, the kinds of people we can write off as they're going to be no good anyway. Mm. Can I ask you, before we go on to Fear of Flying and start to compare and contrast, what was the process like? Because I think everyone wants to know. Mm. You've got this hit play, right? This is their people are nodding. This is all they've come for. you've got this hit play. People are raving about it. Jodie Comer's winning an actual Tony. You've won the Olivier. You cannot get a ticket. You literally...
Jodie won a Tony.
Yeah. I heard Phoebe Waller-Bridge had to sit in the lighting booth to watch it. Now, can I ask
she
you...
She probably wanted to sit there.
I don't... This is what she... Oh, that's right. She told me that, actually. Yeah. She said, you've got to go and see it. I had to sit in the lighting booth. Well, I thought, well, if you had to sit in the lighting booth, I'm not going to see it. She's Jodie Comer's best mate.
Yeah, she is.
Killing Eve.
You're right. Yeah,
so we couldn't get tickets. Oh. And I ended up seeing it in America and I watched the National Theatre Live of it. But it was really hard to... Did anyone try and get in and couldn't and has had to watch National Theatre Live? Yeah. So, okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Who says, right, make this into a novel, and how intimidating is that?
Not at all. In fact, to be honest, it was probably a novel before it was a play in some regards.
Oh.
So what happened is that I did so much research and I wrote so much that, you know, Jodie would have been on stage for like 6 hours. And no one can learn that many words. And then I thought one day I'll write it into a book, but my first craft is theatre writing and I was planning on writing a play. It's looking a bit like a novel. I will extract what I can for the play and then put it, you know, sat by my desk in all the different forms that I'd written. And I crafted it into a play, but every time I did and every time I heard a read, it was still too long. So the amount of things that I had to take out that was so fundamental to the story for me, they say kill your darlings in theatre and I certainly had to, but I didn't kill them, I just put them to the side.
Yes.
Shelve your darlings. Your darlings for a novel. God, that feels better, doesn't it?
What was it?
Shave your darlings. That's what we should
say. My edit darlings.
Pop that darling into your bottom drawer.
Do you know what directors who are quite smart say to playwrights when they're going, you know, this scene, and I'm not letting it go. And they go, let's just put it in the car park and we'll come back to it later. And you go, okay. But you go, I just know no one's ever going to go to that car park.
My partner does this to me with my belongings. They go to the attic before they go to the tip.
That's the first stop. That's like telling a pet, telling a child that a pet's gone to
them. Well, if you haven't needed them for the last 5 years.
Yes,
With Primer Faces, they didn't go to the car park because I insisted on putting them on my desk and letting the pile rise. Wow. And then, you know, and then the play's running and I thought, now I'm going to turn to the book that I always wanted to write. I wasn't finished with it because there was so much emotional excavation that I needed to do with the character.
Are we allowed to know one of the darlings that you resurrected?
Yes.
Yeah, well, you've read most of them.
Well, no, but what was the one that you were most sort of excited to
bring
to do?
Back?
I was really excited to delve into the family. I was really excited to bring Mia back. That scene at M&S where...
Yeah. Can you just say to the audience who Mia is?
Mia is the character we were talking about before that she met at Cambridge, that she sort of had the instinct, we'll never be friends. She's got a private school haircut, all that sort of like, and she had decided that Mia wasn't for her. But Mia ends up being her best friend at Cambridge and then says to her, look, I'm dropping out, I'm going to go to acting school. But you know, she, Mia, before she drops out, sort of takes, you know, she knows where Tessa comes from, but she never labours that, and she actually goes out of her way to support Tessa later, but without trying to do it in the most kind of equitable, like, kind way, really, because she has got a trust fund, and she says, look, I've got this money that you can pay your rent with. I'm never going to use it. I'd prefer it was used in a good way. And she's trying to find a way to be generous without being like a charity case. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, like, I mean, I've met women like that that do have that kind of background, which, of course, those of us that didn't when we started off have a bit of a chip on our shoulder about. And then they kind of kill you with their kindness in a way at a time that you need it, or they're prepared to mop up your tears. And I wanted Mia to be that. I think that in the play I wasn't able to elaborate as much on her female friendships. Yeah. And I feel like there's no woman that doesn't have a kind of posse of female friendships, be they the Alices that let you down or the Mias that rise to the top. And I wanted her in court to have that. Also, one of the little darlings that I picked up was baby Junie. Because her brother has a baby.
Was baby Junie in the
play? No, not at all.
No, she wasn't. But was she meant to be in the play?
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, but we weren't going to have her.
Was she
in
the car park?
She was car park.
I thought she was written especially for the novel.
Well, I think she came, I mean, basically there was a touch on the fact that, you know, Cheryl was having a baby. But I actually, we let her get birthed in the book and have a role to play, and also to show you, I guess, you know, everything does more than one thing. And so when Cheryl comes into the court, you're not allowed to be in court with a child, which means so many women can't actually be in the gallery at court because they have small children. So, it, you know, there's so many layers where women are excluded, and that's one probably most people won't even see or read. But I wanted to actually add that into the book so that you got a sense that she has to sit outside with the baby because you're not allowed to bring a baby in. So, and, I, you know, it's an interesting thing that we've actually created a system where not everyone's welcome, basically. Like breastfeeding mothers are not welcome. Babies aren't welcome, you know. I mean, so I, you know, I just wanted to put a little bit of touch.
I didn't know baby Junie was. Never occurred to me that baby Junie was going to be in the play. And
In the outline of the whole story before the play kind of extracted.
I'm delighted that we went and visited that dusty old car park, and baby Junie's there going, "Oh my god, I thought it was abandoned," and here I'm wheeled up for the novel. It's just absolutely fantastic.
She's the future, really. I mean, you look at a young baby girl and you think, if I don't fight this now, then she's going to go through the same fight.
That's the other thing I thought, that she was sort of the young self that she was fighting for the future, saying, look, it's too late for me. And, you know, this has happened to me, but we have to change the law and the way the law works, because it's just not working. I just think, surely, if 99% of house break and enters get off? Surely not.
No.
Surely it can't be that stat.
Definitely.
Was there anything else about writing the novel that surprised you? Is this your first novel?
It is my first novel. But
so was there anything being a playwright that surprised you?
Yeah, it really did. I was surprised at how much I enjoyed it, because I thought, I've got lovely editors, and some of them are in here today, so I'm really grateful that they're here, and beautiful agents who just encourage me. I can't say that happens in theatre all the time, does it?
You work with the actors, I guess, more.
Yeah, true. But you don't normally get to the actor until you've finished at least, you know, pretty close to final draft. I think the other thing was just not having directors' voices in my head as I'm writing, where they're going, nope, can't stage that, take that out. You know, it was lovely to write into the stuff that I really wanted to say. But also I could have as many characters as I wanted.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's the great thing. Well, you famously only have, you know, it's a one-woman show.
But there's about, you know, 30-plus characters. But now there's even more. Because, you know, I could actually... I mean, she can't talk to Mia forever on her own. But in the book, Mia could exist. So.
But it's a really economical, you know, the producers must have just gone, oh, my God, one performer, yes, fucking please. One performer, effectively one. But in a book, of course, you just don't have to think about that. No. There's something I was writing as a TV script that now I'm writing as a novel, and I'm like, this is so brilliant, because you don't have to think we can't afford that set. Because, the great thing about readers is you imagine the whole budget. It's in your head.
Yeah.
You imagine the whole budget, you imagine the edit, you imagine everything. It's just, if you can afford a bit of paper, then, you know, that's.
Yeah, and it's been interesting for me because, of course, I know Jodie very well and I've watched the play a number of times, but hearing her do the audio book, I was like, oh, this is the beauty of prose, is that you're inside the head of the person reading it, and the person reading it to you is whispering as the character right into your ear. And there's something quite nuanced about that, and I think that that's how you read when you read a novel compared to reading or watching a play, is that you are in the body of the person who's telling you the story. And it's a first-person story. Yeah. So, you know, you are with her, and I think when you put it down, you've had a whole experience with Tessa as a human being as opposed to just watching her perform.
Yeah, I felt I knew her a lot better. And I loved getting to know her through the play. And then I felt like, oh, wow, now I'm just, it's just getting to spend time with someone. If I could have hot-seated Jodie Comer at the end and asked her lots of questions and gone, take me to your house for dinner and can I have a cup of tea with you and your best friend? It's, you know, I got to go into all of those places because you've got that luxury of time.
Well, Jodie was great because, of course, she'd prepared her character for the play and made up some backstory. And then she said, wow, then I heard the real backstory. And I was like, oh, yeah. She goes, but it made sense. It made a lot of sense.
So. Interesting.
And she sort of, there's a lot more about the family in the book as well.
Yeah, which is what I enjoyed very much because I understood her character more. Not that you would have wanted the play to be any longer because, you know, it's such an incredible whirlwind, but that, you know, you can read for an hour at a time and, you know, really get to know someone over a longer period of time, which is great.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hello, Guilty Feminists. This is Deborah. Our tour down under begins and we can announce our amazing co-hosts for these shows on the 11th of May in Auckland, the 14th of May in Wellington and the 15th of May in Christchurch. I am going to be co-hosting for the first time with the incredible stand-up comedian from Aotearoa, Michelle Acourt. I know she's huge in New Zealand and a massive feminist, and I'm very, very excited. We tried to work with her before, and her daughter very inconveniently gave birth that night. So I can't think of a more feminist reason not to come. So we're very, very excited. Then we'll be in Adelaide on the 18th of May with Geraldine Hickey. After that, we're coming to you, Perth, on the 20th of May with Claire Hooper. Then we'll be in Sydney on the 23rd of May with Geraldine Hickey. And then we'll be in Melbourne on the 25th of May. I am not allowed to say who the co-host is, but she is a big Australian favourite and she's amazing. I am not allowed to announce her yet because she's so famous and fabulous. And the guest is an A-list Australian star. Again, we're just getting permission to announce her. So I would recommend if you're in Melbourne especially, our tickets are going fast everywhere, but I would recommend if you're in Melbourne especially, you get your tickets now before the announcement is made because you are going to want to see these people. And we also have some incredible activist voices and other special stuff going on. The last two dates are in Brisbane on the 27th of May with the wonderful Alice Fraser and in Canberra on 28th of May. We end the tour with Kirsty Wiebeck. Grace Petrie is coming out and she's doing all the dates with me. We're also going to have poets, activists, incredible guests. It's going to be, do you remember how buzzy the tour was last time and everyone was hysterical at the end? It's going to be like that again. So do not miss out. Get tickets now at guiltyfeminist.com and click on live shows. You can also get an ad-free version of the podcast from Patreon, Apple Podcasts or Acast Plus from as little as £2.50 a month. And that really helps to support the podcast and pay all the wonderful people who support me in bringing you The Guilty Feminist every week. You can also show support in a way that costs you nothing by going to Apple Podcasts or Spotify and giving The Guilty Feminist a 5-star review, even though you've done it before, because it really, really helps other people find us in a very crowded market with a weird algorithm pushing people further to alt-right content every week. And so we'd really, really love it if you'd tell people about it, share it online. And now back to the podcast. We should probably start contrasting with Fear of Flying. So I'm going to read the opening.
She's very funny in this opening too, isn't she?
Yes, she is. There were 117 psychoanalysts on the Pan Am flight to Vienna, and I'd been treated by at least six of them. and married a seventh. God knows it was a tribute either to the shrink's ineptitude or my own glorious unanalyzability that I was now, if anything, more scared of flying than when I began my analytic adventures some 13 years earlier. My husband grabbed my hand therapeutically at the moment of takeoff. "Christ, it's like ice," he said. He ought to know the symptoms by now since he's held my hand on lots of other flights. My fingers and toes turn to ice. My stomach leaps upwards into my rib cage. The temperature in the tip of my nose drops to the same level as the temperature in my fingers. My nipples stand up and salute the inside of my bra, or in this case, dress, since I'm not wearing a bra. And for one screaming minute, my heart and the engines correspond as we attempt to prove again that the laws of aerodynamics are not the flimsy superstitions, which in my heart of hearts, I know they are. Never mind the diabolical explanations of airfoil you get in Pan Am's multilingual information to passengers, I happen to be convinced that only my own concentration and that of my mother, who always seems to expect her children to die in a plane crash, keeps this bird aloft. I congratulate myself on every successful takeoff, but not too enthusiastically, because it's also part of my personal religion that the minute you grow overconfident and really relax into the flight, the plane crashes instantly. So it's beautifully written. It's very funny, very witty. And the reason I wanted to compare them was they're both interior monologues from women where you're only really finding out about everyone else by what they tell you. You've only got one narrator and you've got to trust them because you're along for the ride with them. Mm. Also, similar themes, although dealt with very differently. So had anyone read this book before?
No, I haven't.
Eliana, you look like you're raring to go there.
It was like the section that you chose to read, which was the beginning of the book, when she talks about her unanalyzability. I'm sort of comparing it to prima facie, that there is this element of she's trying to fit herself into, I mean, in this particular book, quite like Freudian male psychoanalyst, and she like can't get into that structure that has been built by men. Mm. And it's the sort of same thing of women trying to can't really work out why they can't fit into this structure that wasn't built for them.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point. Yes, yeah. It's the wig, isn't it? It's the wig that doesn't really quite fit you, or wasn't really made for somebody mm-hmm. like you, but you're trying to put it on. But it's a different, the wig's a different sort of head shrinker. Susie, What did you think of this book?
Well, you know, I actually really loved it because I'd never seen the journey towards second wave feminism and what it involved. I mean, you know, I'd always heard about it theoretically and I'd discussed it at university. But it was such a joyous ride through it, just that kind of pull of like a woman's sexual desire and this need for security, and that they're the two things that they think they're battling, but actually really the third thing to emerge, and it does by the end, slight spoiler alert, but her recognition that she's not defined by other people, that and her sexuality is not defined by other people, and she doesn't have to be scared all the time about whether she's fitting the right roles. And I really loved towards the end how her whole kind of sexual journey took her to a place where she was always anxious about which one would love her or which one wouldn't, or who she was hurting or guilty about something all the time. And she got to the end where it was like, you know what, I actually can look after myself and I'm prepared to take the responsibility for the decisions that I make along the way, which, you know, is that I guess it's basically she just became a woman that was making choices for her rather than for everybody else. But she had a real journey of it, for sure.
It took me ages to realise that's what was happening.
Not until the very end.
Well, I think because it took her ages to realise that.
Yeah.
The whole way through was like, I'm just looking to have sex. And then
never fully got to trust her in that.
But that's the sort of second wave of it all, isn't it, really? It's like waking women up. You do not have to be in a kitchen with a blender and you know, washing a husband's pants. That isn't all there is. So if she knows
like
that on page one.
If she knows
that on page one, then the women reading it at the time, you know, are not going to have the wake up with her, really, I suppose, the enlightenment with her.
That she was prepared to talk about sex in kind of colloquial language, like just referring to fucking. You know, like for a woman to say that in 1973 and just like own it was already like a big jump in some regards. It's just that how she defined it was so much about male desire, even though she was inserting herself in it until she discovered, actually, it should be about what I want.
Yeah.
Yes, or at least from my point of view, at least I'm allowed to have a I think fantasy.
The thing that the passage that you open with, like from the beginning of the book, I think if there is a parallel to draw in terms of with prima facie as well, like that holding on to values even in a context where they are just unappliable, that played into that as well. There's a bit where she comes back later to the flying, and there's just one line I can't find it exactly, so sorry for paraphrasing, but she says, "No one's an atheist when they're on a crashing plane." And I was like, "Oh,
that's so true.
I love that." Yeah. And it is like, how do you hold on to this? Like, even your most fundamental belief systems and structures are destroyable, can be burnt down when it turns out actually there's one place in which they're not going to be a success. Like, yes. I think that's really interesting. And I think a bit like you were saying there as well, this is a second thought that's not tied to that, but her sexuality is so exciting in this. And I imagine it's so easy to read that now. And I'm sure this can't have been when it was written, this would have been a much more transgressive read. When I got this out back in,
now, to be honest,
it's pretty racy. There's a bit where I got this out when I was reading this in front of my mum, and she went, "Oh, that's from my time." And I said, and she went, "It's all sex. That's all porny sex, isn't it?" And I was like, I'd just been like, basically, look, I mean, the vast majority of the sex in it is shit. Like, it makes you feel sick. Like, it's disgusting. And I loved it. I was like, it's not giving me a stonk on, mum, if it's meant to. Is that what you had for? Is that what you had to try and get off on in the 70s?
Is that what you said to your mum?
You. No, I didn't. No, actually, no.
I just couldn't say that to my mum.
No,
she does listen to the podcast, doesn't she?
She might listen to the podcast, yeah.
She might listen to
it. I feel like as well there's a really interesting thing. There's a journey she goes on that's I don't know which wave of feminism it is, but I feel like we repeat this mistake again and again. Mistake, whatever. We have this journey again and again. Like we did it in the 90s again, where our version of empowerment is to do as men do, and this kind of Ladette thing we did in the 90s, there's a bit of that here. Like, can I read one of my favorite
bits?
I think it's so funny, but she talks about men behaving like this, and then this just feels like the most ultimate guilty feminist bit of this. She talks about how so often she feels like this about men. Their minds were hopelessly befuddled, but their bodies were so nice. Their ideas were intolerable, but their penises were silky. I had been a feminist all my life. I date my radicalization to the night in 1955 when the IRT subway, when the moronic Horace Mann boy who was my date asked me if I planned to be a secretary. That's in the brackets. But the big problem was how to make your feminism jibe with your unappeasable hunger for male bodies. It wasn't easy. And she talks about her hunger thump all the way through it. And that's such a powerful description of her sexuality. I think it's amazing.
Can I do another quick sex one?
Yeah.
Okay, it's really quick. So she's talking about, she's met a man called Charlie. She says, "We went home to bed, but Charlie was so overwhelmed by his good luck that he wilted." "Conduct me," I said.
That's right, he's a conductor.
Yes, that's right. "Conduct me," I said. "I seem to have lost my baton." "Well, then do it like Metropolis, with your bare hands." "You're a real find," he said. Thrashing around under the covers. But hand or baton, it was hopeless. His teeth were chattering and great shudders were shaking his shoulders. He was gasping for breath like an emphysema patient. "What's the matter?" I asked. "It's just that you're such a find, I can't believe it." He seemed to be sobbing and choking alternately. "Will you see me again in spite of this?" he pleaded. "You promise you won't hold this against me." "What kind of ghoul do you think I am?" I was astonished. All my maternal instincts had been roused by his helplessness. "What kind of creep would throw you out?" "The last one this happened with," he moaned. "She threw me out and tossed my clothes to me in the hall. She forgot one sock. I had to go home on the subway with one bare ankle. It was the most humiliating experience of my life." "Darling," I said, rocking him. I mean, it's these very kind of explicit snapshots, and she never takes impotence personally. She never goes, "Oh, do you not fancy me then?" She just goes, "Oh, that's sad for you. You know, that's, I mean, no, that's normal. That's what happens and that's fine. And we can do other things." And, you know,
happens quite a lot in the book.
Yeah. It does. Yeah.
With most of her, it's not her, as in, like, it actually isn't her. Like, her sexual partners sort of seem
it's the normality of it.
Yeah. But
she,
actually,
she falls, like, I'm still blown away by the idea that people were getting off on these descriptions. She falls in love with him even though he can't wipe his ass.
This was the first feminist book I knowingly ever read. Like, I remember a friend giving this to me probably in the 90s when that whole Ladakh culture was going on. And she said, like, this is a really feminist book, and I read it all. And I remembered that so much that he left marks on the sheet. Isn't it awful? But there are lots of things in it. It's just, as I say, it's the original Fleabag. It's like there's all of this just graphic content. Can I ask you, Eliana, because this book is so Jewish and so very specific about this time, and you forget, like, okay, this is 73. Forget how close that was to the Second World War. It was in such living memory. I mean, she was born in the 30s. She was born during the war.
Yeah.
So how did that land with you? The woman, the desire, the oppression, the fear?
The mother.
Yeah, the mother. I mean, it felt very... I knew the author was Jewish. I didn't expect... The book is very Jewish. And she sort of arrives in Germany, she goes to Vienna, but she's been living in Germany. And the sort of descriptions... Like, there's just a general unease. And it's something that I don't know how you can imagine it if you don't feel it. Like, I know I went to Poland for the first time 2 years ago to speak at a Holocaust event about my grandfather's story. And it was the first time that I'd set foot in Poland. And that was where most of my ancestors were killed. And I was in the airport and I was just like, oh, I feel really uncomfortable. Mm. And I know that, you know, the likelihood of someone being alive now who was doing anything bad back then is very slim, but there is just something there. And but then also the sort of Jewish humour, and, you know, she arrives at the conference and she tries to get in and she hasn't actually arranged it. And the woman on the front is like, I won't do a German accent, but I'm so sorry, we can't let you in. And she's like, expect you're just following orders then. Like, just this, like, you can't shake it. Like, that's where your brain goes.
What did I say? It's on the ground. It's
visceral. It's visceral. Every time she looks, you know, the person she sleeps with is blonde. Like, everything factors into that. And I think that is this very Jewish thing of it kind of... I don't know what it's like if you aren't... You know, if your family haven't been involved. But involved as in, like, you know, we're a Holocaust survivor family. But it is this sort of feeling that you sort of get in the air in certain places where you know what has gone on. And it's not really rational because nowadays, I mean, when she was there, probably a lot more rational than, you know, me going to Berlin nowadays. But going to a certain place, that does feel like there's something there, and that comes across really strongly in the book.
Yes. Well, I've been researching the similar period in the UK at that time, and the anti-Semitism here was absolutely extraordinary. And that doesn't just go away after the war. It's not like, well, the war's done now, anti-Semitism's over. It's generations, you know. It's obviously still very much an issue now. But that feeling that she gets going back, how does that mix in with the analyst of it all? Because she says the psychoanalysts were driven out of Germany and Austria. And then
is the Jewish science.
Yes. And so then they're all coming back to have a conference of analysts there, which is a sort of, I guess, is it a bold political move to do that? Or was it just where the conference centre was available?
I mean, it must have been. I mean, look, when she describes the analyst coming back, she goes to Freud's house in one of the bits of the book. And he's like, and then Freud left, like, as if he just sort of decided he was going to go on a cruise. Like, you know, it's obviously he was driven out with every other Jew.
That's my Uber.
Like, that's me off. So, you know, there is this element of kind of, I think at that point, a little bit brushing over what happened. I think, you know, Germany, for example, has really as a country had to hold its hands up in a way that the UK never has, and other countries haven't. At this point in time, I think it's a little bit before everyone's sort of totally owned up to it. I think that will come. But where she's at, there is just this sort of brushing over this entire period of time as if it didn't really happen.
Well, even in America, I had to buy Life magazine from 1939 because of a character I'm researching, and the real person was on the front. So I thought, oh, great, there'll be a little article about her. Brilliant. And because it's early 1939, there's excerpts, you know, like when there's a new Elizabeth Day book out and they do excerpts in the Sunday Times. Exactly like that, only Mein Kampf. Excerpts of Mein Kampf in English. And it's like, just so Americans can know, this is Hitler's agenda, and, you know, it's just absolutely horrendous. And then 3 pages later, it's like, we have to be aware in America of fascism in the same way we have to be aware of communism. And then there's, here's what fascism in America looks like. And then there's the most anti-Semitic tropes and statements and you've ever seen in your life. And they are saying, be aware, but the fact that they can just publish it, I was just thinking, God, imagine being Jewish and just like, oh, Life magazine, Tallulah Bankhead on the front, lovely. Oh, fuck. You know, it's just the most horrendous arresting stuff. And in 39, even in America, it just wasn't seen as horrifying and fascist in that same way. So to be going back, and also, the book came out in 73, but it's not as, you know, I think it's widely seen as a lot of the events are very similar to Erica Jong's life, so there's a memoir element to it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that might have been in the 60s that she was going back. I'm sure it didn't happen in 1973, that's when the book came out. So it might have been the 60s. So you think the 40s to the 60s, well, that's what now, what year would it be if we're looking at 2024? So that would be 2000, the mid-noughties we'd be looking at. Imagine going somewhere where you were driven out and horrendous genocide happened in the mid-noughties. You would very much be frightened of going there.
But she also sort of, you know, it's part of her day-to-day. I mean, she goes to visit her brother-in-law in, I think, Egypt, and the whole way through.
No, he's in Lebanon.
Oh, he's in Lebanon. Mm. Oh, I can't remember. Oh, she was sat next to an Egyptian person on the plane. Yeah. And there is this part of her that is just really, like, obviously has to deny that she's Jewish. And I think he looks at, is it Golda Meir on the cover of a magazine? And he's like, she's a Jew. And she's sort of being like, well, I probably shouldn't say so am I. Like, I'll just keep that to myself. And that's, you know, she's not, anti-Semitism isn't this thing that she views as like, well, that was then and now it's now. And it's obviously horrific at the moment. So it is this continuation that she's sort of having to deal with it as a thing of the past and take that in, and a thing, a different thing in the present and take that in.
But she's also, sorry, Tom, we've got 15 minutes left, no? Oh, yes, good point. Thank you, darling. But the patriarchy lives. listen, sometimes the patriarchy is useful. It's not mansplaining if you didn't know. It's just explaining. sorry, what were you saying?
I've absolutely no idea. Okay.
Can I just say something, though?
I'd love you to.
Well, I'm just going to read a little tiny bit because I think this sort of sums up something else that's right through the book. He says to her, "You're a princess. Forgive me for trying to upset your safe little marriage." She turned the key in the ignition and started the car for emphasis. "Fuck you, Adrian. It was lame, but it was all I could think of. Don't fuck me. Go home and fuck yourself. Go back to being a safe little bourgeois housewife who writes in her spare time." That was the unkindest cut of all. And in fact, it is these sort of tropes. Like, the one thing she wanted to do was be someone that could contribute and write and have her own life. But people kept suggesting or implying that her place was somewhere else. And I think even her family, with the kind of pressure to have children, and, you know, she just hadn't decided, or she might not have them, and she wanted to be a writer, and that was such a struggle. And I look at my life now, it's to be a writer is something you can choose to do without people saying, you should be a housewife or you should be married or, well, I am married. But
just before we go to Q&A, just one thing I did want to say in terms of contrasting the book. You know, the interior monologue is so wonderful to kind of really get in with somebody, but the treatment of sexual assault is so incredibly different. Like, men grab her ass and she's kind of flattered by it. Like, she's like, oh, you know, it's nice to be desired. And we're still at this point in the book. I think she does come to, at the end, this realization, but she's like, it's really nice to be desired rather than nice to desire. It's like, oh, that's a signal. And I really relate to that. Like, not that I want anyone to grab my ass, but, you know, like that sort of thing of, this isn't in the bedroom. This is a man at a conference. Yeah. And, you know, this is what women were dealing with all the time. But they're also, the sort of training that your brain had was that was a sign that you were fancied.
Yeah, I remember my mum, actually, God bless her, I loved her to bits. But, you know, I always remember that, you know, she was quite glamorous. And, she, you know, if someone whistled as she walked down the street and I was like a 12-year-old kind of mini feminist going, that's outrageous. And she would go, oh, I can't help it if I'm attractive. She doesn't understand, you know. But, you know, there was that kind of 70s thing of like, oh, you know, I'm one of the birds rather than sure. I'm one of the people.
She's, she sort of talks about it at the end when she's like, the problem is, you know, when someone essentially tries to assault her, well, assault her on a train.
Yeah.
And she's like, she just is kind of grappling with it in her mind where she's like, if I say no to a man, he'll think, you know, I don't want to do it because, you know, I don't want to have another notch on my belt, bed, yeah, whatever, yeah, the bed phrase bed. Is. Yeah. Like, you know, it's nothing to do with him. It's nothing to do with like her not wanting him. Yeah. It's only to do with her.
Yeah.
Whereas if she made a move on a guy and he rejected her, it is like, okay, now we start the inner monologue of the thousand things that I hate most about myself. And these are the reasons why he doesn't want me. Not just like, you know, he doesn't want to have sex right now. It just, it is obviously a reflection of you. If you're a woman being rejected, you have failed.
Mm. Yes. She eventually does have her zipless funk, but it's not what she thinks. It is an assault. Because how can you... You know, I suppose some people have just looked at each other in a library and gone into the loo and done it and come out and felt amazing. But not me. I went to the loo and he never turned up. But she says afterwards, it wasn't, the whole book is zipless fuck, zipless fuck. And then she says, it wasn't until I was settled facing a nice little family group, mother, daddy, baby, that it dawned on me how funny that episode had been. My zipless fuck, my stranger on a train, here I'd been offered my very own fantasy, the fantasy that had riveted me to the vibrating seat of the train for 3 years in Heidelberg, and instead of turning me on, it had revolted me. Puzzling, wasn't it? A tribute to the mysteriousness of the psyche, or maybe my psyche had begun to change in a way I hadn't anticipated. There was no longer anything romantic about strangers on trains. So she acknowledges how horrendous that was. But she speaks about it in a very, not at all like your character who, you know, is in the 21st century and is like, I know what that was. Mm. And that, and I own that trauma in my body and I speak to that trauma. She's like disassociating. She's like, oh, well, that fantasy wasn't, you know, what I wanted. And, you know, so it's a really
it's
interesting.
The brushing off of a sexual assault, isn't yeah. it? Rather than making an excuse that it wasn't what, it's not my fantasy. Rather than, oh, wow, that was really non-consensual.
Mm. Yeah. The disassociation that you have to do if there's no power structure telling you that's unacceptable or that's illegal or that's you know, something you can action. So we should do a Q&A now. Does anyone have a cue so we can A it?
Thanks for a great discussion and... I don't know if I speak for other people here, but I do plan on reading a book club book. I just picked it up tonight, so I haven't had a chance to read it yet.
Excellent. Sorry, I hope we haven't spoiled it for you.
I will forget everything, don't worry.
Excellent.
It was a great primer. I actually am curious, something that I've been mulling over since seeing your fantastic play. I was very lucky to come across some tickets being available, and I'm really looking forward to reading the novel as well. But it's been playing on my mind, and you touched on it earlier, this... pervasive myth that these women or that women who are alleging that these crimes have been made against them and against their persons are using the courts to punish men for vindictive reasons. Mm. I cannot quite understand why that myth persists so strongly in our society and certain other societies around the world when it is patently evident in so many different ways that, firstly, as you said, that's not what the justice system is for and that's not how it works. Mm. But also, they don't often get justice, assuming that this has happened.
Yeah.
Surely for that myth to be logical, they'd actually have to get the outcome that vindicates them
yeah.
and brings them justice. And on the flip side, and this is a horrible and rather generalizing thing to say, but I feel slightly justified, if men want to punish a former partner or a woman who's spurned them or rejected them, they don't have to use the courts to do that and very rarely actually end up in court for doing that.
Yeah, it's true.
How can we change that now? Like, how do we...
Well, there have been some changes, actually, I mean, with the book and with the play. And that's because, and this is really interesting to me, I mean, well, because the Old Bailey has parity of gender in judges. It's a very new thing. And it was interesting to me that the calls I had were from female judges. And one of them said, you know, I've actually changed the law so that what judges now must read to the jury in a rape case is that recognizing the trauma that the woman's in, and if things are not as consistent as you wish, it could be because they're traumatized, not because they're lying. So it's actually about, rather than you're lying or you're telling the truth, it could be that, it could even be in a rape case that two people are telling the truth, that someone was raped and someone doesn't know they did it. And I think that women who are complainants, if they don't win their case, which is, you know, 98.7 of them, they need to be told. And I actually said this recently to a group of judges when I launched this book at Waterstones in Liverpool, because there are a couple of judges there. And I said, you know, they need to be told that just because you didn't win your case doesn't mean that you're not believed or that it didn't happen, because that's not what the proof is. But the way defence barristers, like, try to undermine their stories to make it as, give it as little possibility of being true by throwing so many things at them. One of the other things that the judges do now is recognise that to freeze or to friend are the way women survive something that is, you know, like violent and an attempt on their life at times as well. Because to fight or flight is the usual expression that we use in terms of when someone's offending you. But if they're so much physically bigger than you, to fight or fright can actually antagonise someone further and make it worse. And so actually instinctively to freeze or to try to befriend by saying, I'm just going to go to the bathroom or whatever to try to get out, but that's used against you in court by saying, oh, you know, you were chatting away and you were saying, oh, you know, you're a really nice guy, I just have to stand outside for a while or whatever. Those two tactics, to freeze or to friend, are used against them in court as reasons that they can't be believed, because obviously you didn't try to leave or fight or kick and scream. But actually they're two very strong survival tactics that women use when they're you know, threatened. Their bodies are threatened. So I feel like there's an opening up of that conversation because women judges are in that role.
Was policy changed based on those judges seeing your play?
Yeah, it was.
That's incredible.
It's amazing.
That's absolutely incredible.
It was amazing for me. I mean, I got a phone call.
That's incredible,
like,
Susan.
9 a.m. one morning with a judge saying to me, look, I just want you to know I saw the play last night. I've been thinking about it all night. There's something wrong and I think I can do one thing, which is the direction to the jury can be changed because I'm the person that drafts them. One of the judges at the Old Bailey made it compulsory viewing for judges in Northern Ireland, and now there's some possibility of other places as well.
How did they get tickets?
No, well, they actually have the NT Live version to screen for all the judges before they're allowed to sit on a rape case, which is kind of interesting.
That's incredible.
But the book as well now is doing the same thing. Like,
oh,
you can
my God.
Read the book or see a video.
That's fantastic. I'm so glad about the book because so many more people can read a book than can access a theatre and West End ticket prices and all that kind of thing and have the time to go and do it and the access and all of that. So that's an incredible thing. I know it's touring everywhere and there's like 8 productions going on in Germany at the moment.
No, there's 20.
20 in Germany.
20 different productions. I mean, the Germans have responded to the book really strongly as well. Like, they're going, we've got a different legal system, but it's exactly the same.
Right.
Because gender is everywhere, right? But you know, like, some the police are also using the book as a tool to see what they do wrong when they actually take statements, because they take a statement as if you're never going to be believed. So how much time will I spend with this?
A friend of mine was sexually assaulted on a bus and the defence barrister said, well, why didn't you scream? And she said, my body went into freeze. Mm. Fortunately, the CCTV camera showed it and, you know, enough of what happened. But her response was to just freeze and then get off, push past him, and he went to get off the bus. So she got off and then quickly got back on. So he followed her. So she jumped back on as the door shut. And she did go straight to the police, but fortunately the CCTV bore out, although couldn't see everything, bore out what she said, and he did go to jail. But the defence barrister asked her that, and I could see as he asked her, his face, he looked ashamed. He was like, you know, you could see he just looked so ashamed at asking a question, but that's, you know, he feels that's his job to ask that question.
Do you know what's interesting though? The CCTV footage, for example, is often defence barristers go, do you have any CCTV footage or film of what you're saying happened? Now, who on earth has that of their rape?
Well, it was a... No,
she's lucky that she did.
It was a bus. You couldn't see, but everything she said happened about when he sat down, when she got off, you know. Like, but he was asking her all sorts of questions like, you know, they're trying to kind of go, but it wasn't red, it was blue.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's, yeah. Everyone's memories are like that. And in fact, exactly. If you've made the story up, you've made up all the details and you've written them down and you've, you know, yeah. It's much more likely you'll forget things. Anyway, any other questions?
Hi, good evening. A lot of the themes you've talked about tonight have reminded me of the book A Woman in Berlin. And have we as a society really moved on? Because we've talked about how women use stoicism and disassociation to deal with periods of trauma and be able to get through something even as traumatic as a cross-examination in a jury system. Do you think it's actually a wider question for society to come to acceptance of what rape actually is?
Absolutely.
And it's not just isolated to a court case?
Absolutely. I think that the law follows the community and it's always lags behind. But if you're thinking that this is at least one in three women that this happens to, then we've got so much more work to do within the community. And also, you know, if a young girl goes to her mother and says, this happens to me, we've all got our own internalized patriarchal kind of views that we don't often acknowledge. And, you know, to say to someone in a kind of response like, why did you go to his house? It's the worst thing you can possibly say, because it's completely normal to go out, have a drink, go to someone's house, you know. But we assume that a girl doing that is opening themselves up for risk. And, you know, like the fact that somehow or other that's their fault is completely like misguided.
It's like, why did you walk home alone? Why did you get an Uber? Why did you get in the car with him? Well, you've got to get home somehow.
And I think men are absolutely astonished that every woman I know and probably every woman you know has walked home from the tube at some stage with their keys and their phone.
Oh, yeah.
And they're not just scared someone's going to steal their phone. They're scared they're going to be raped and murdered. I mean, actually strategically and being vigilant about who's on the other side and, oh, my God, they've slowed down. Should I slow down? Should I cross over when they cross over? Or does that make me look scared? I mean, it's crazy that, you know, we've normalized that that's actually something that we don't even expect someone to do anything about anymore.
And I was thinking, I don't want that man to think I'm scared of him, but I am. So I'm just playing the odds.
Yeah.
I don't think he's necessarily an attacker, but I always like it also when men cross the road because they just know, you know, I don't want to be that guy. There was a question there.
Thank you. Firstly, I wanted to say thank you, Susie. I've worked in the sexual violence sector for the best part of a decade, and the number of survivors that have spoken to me about your play and acknowledged the change that it made for them is phenomenal. But as somebody who did get the privilege of sitting in the theatre, actually what struck me was the number of men who came out afterwards and went, I've never thought about it like that. I've never understood it that way. So I have no doubt it's changing stuff. But one of the things that really strikes me is that feminism for a very long time has been campaigning to change a system that's broken. Mm. And it feels almost odd to me that we're still doing it, that we're still saying the solution to sexual violence is to somehow make a patriarchal legal system fit for purpose.
Yeah.
Views on that, thoughts on that, I guess. Is it something we can actually achieve within our lifetime?
I totally hear you. And I think we have to be creative about brainstorming different systems, to be honest. Even if it's as basic as a sexual assault like specialist court, so that there's psychiatrists on hand, that there's protection of complainants, and that the process is explained what you can get out of it, and that if you don't win your case, that it's not because of you. I also think that, you know, there's room for different ways of actually finding out what complainants want. Sometimes they just want an apology and an acknowledgement. It's a really simple thing. But no one's ever taken that into account in the legal system. I mean, it's never even forthcoming, even if you win your case, frankly. It might be in sentencing, but often the complainant isn't there when they say, oh, I'm really contrite now that I've been found guilty. But I think we've got to brainstorm different ways and victim-centred ways for how they view justice and how they can actually move ahead with their life in the least traumatic way and with the most positive outcome. And that might be about actually finding ways to do some sort of restorative process or something that's different. And they're trialling that in New York at the moment. And there's all these young, amazing women in New York working with the UN and working with women and complainants and thinking about it from a feminist perspective rather than just thinking of it as like fixing the broken system that it is. I mean, the broken system comes from hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years of men deciding what rape is and basically deciding that if a woman's not saying no, then they're not saying no. And there's so many ways to say no and you should be looking for a yes. Mm.
But also that prison is designed to isolate people, make them angry, bitter, not at all, you know, or just thinking about how they can change, because it's all about disconnection. Mm. So it's all fucked, basically. And I'm really happy that you've unfucked a tiny bit of it with your amazing play and book. Oh, we've just got one last question here, and then we're probably going to have to finish because we've just run over a tiny bit. Just one just there.
I love that we've got the men running around doing the...
Hi, Susie. First of all, I just want to say thank you so much. Honestly, your play is the inspiration for my doctorate, which is actually about the Me Too movement in the theater. Oh, wow. And I just wanted to ask, how did you deal with any backlash you may have received when first putting on this play?
Because I thought I was going to get so much backlash, particularly from lawyers.
Yeah.
And overwhelmingly, they went, oh, yeah, that's true. So,
wow.
You know, that was a shock.
That's amazing.
And the book especially, I have to say, that being able to put it in the hands of people that hopefully they can then put it in the hands of their mother or their sister or their child. I also think that it's really important to actually talk around it and about the male role in this, because it's, you know, it's, and I feel like we have to actually ask or make men aware that they're needed when young men are growing up, when they go into a bro zone, 24/7 porn, though, where there's no in porn because everyone's agreed to do it. So even if they're saying no, like, so they're using porn as education, not entertainment. It's an entertainment tool, it's not an education tool. And you want men who are like sports, you know, sports people or their coaches or their fathers or their big brothers or the cool guy up the road to have a conversation that interrogates that casual misogyny that really kicks in from about 15 to 25 in that way that's how they bond about being kind of cool dudes. And no matter what their feminist mother does, that still happens. So it's like, come on, women can't be responsible for that as well. They have to actually at some stage say, come on, where are the men that are actually interrogating that and saying, look, I might have done that when I was 15 and I now realise how damaging it is and this is why it's not cool.
I think that it's also in answer to the previous question as well. That's such a good point about what we do at the end of this situation. If we've got a legal system that can't, whilst upholding the rule of law, we can't change the law, potentially can't change the law so that he didn't have to know what he was doing. You can't prove that he also knew what he was doing. But that, so where's the incentive? If we're in a situation, we need to change the law when it's a situation where it's not evidence-based, actually. It's one person's word against another. And sexual assault and rape aren't the only instances where it ends up being like that, where there is no CCTV, where it is. And how we look at that, how we frame it, and finding a way of putting an onus on the potential alleged perpetrator as well of... And moving into a world where when it comes to things like this, there is a duty on men...
Affirmative consent.
To get consent.
Yeah,
to
absolutely.
To make sure you, like, and
like,
it's
what
not
did
just
you
how
do
we,
to
like,
maintain
it's so nice to hear that it's not just how we bring up our sons, but it's how men talk to boys and men talk to men in these situations about, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes, absolutely. And also we have to think about more than words because there's such a nuance. If a man had you backed into a corner and was like, you have to say yes, it's the law, you might say yes to save your life. You know, like, it's that sort of... I feel like we have to think about why people would want to force somebody else, and we have to go
absolutely
really, really, really deep on this. I'm going to quickly ask everyone, because we've got to finish. Mm-hmm. Eliana, is there anything you came to say you didn't get to say about either book, both books, or anything you've got to plug?
I think I've said what I want to say about the books, except for just obviously the ending. I will say everyone read Prima Facie, obviously it's unbelievable.
It has a different ending to the play.
Yeah, I would say the play I sort of left and, well, I didn't leave because I was watching it at home because I couldn't get a ticket, but I sort of sat there and was in shock for a while, and then I sort of read the book and I was just like, wow, she's just fixed everything. Like, if we just did exactly what she said, everything would be so much better. So it was honestly the most incredible thing to read. In terms of plugging, I'm working on a play, which is hopefully going into development. So if anyone is interested in a play about a 25-year-old moving into a retirement home to escape the pressures of young adult life, then...
I'm up for that. So where can we follow you on socials to find out what work you're doing?
You can follow me on Instagram, but I've got a website, which is just elianaostro.com. It's very creative.
Excellent. elianaostro.com. And socials... Jess Foster Q, is there anything you came to say you didn't get to say about the books, the themes? You want to go back into law now? Are you going to?
It did make me excited by that world in a way that I'd forgotten. And jury service did. That was the only other time where I thought, oh, God. Yeah, anyway, no, what did I want to say that I didn't get to say?
Yours was my favourite. I'm going to introduce just to people.
I'm on tour. Please come and see me on tour. My show, Metal.
Metals are currently on tour. Yeah, is it coming back into London?
Yes, in June at the Leicester Square Theatre.
Just thinking about these guys. Leicester Square Theatre, it's going to be in June. Jess is one of the greatest stand-ups in the UK, if not the world. So come and see her show, Metal, at the Leicester Square Theatre in June. If you are listening elsewhere, she's travelling around the country.
Wow.
And hopefully outside. I just want to say, firstly, that I think one very encouraging thing is how at this sort of second wave feminist book, how kind of shocking it is in some ways. And that means we've moved on. And it's really easy to always be like, oh, we're not getting anywhere. And those things are important to feel too. It is important to feel angry we're not further. But it's also good to see how far we've come. And that's why it's important to look back. I'd love to do Maya Angelou's first two memoirs. And I mean, all of them are just incredible. A lot of you all have read I Know Where the Caged Bird Sings. But the one after that is unbelievably good. Also deals with some of these themes. And honestly, it's so shocking sometimes when you read the past and you go, oh my God, this is how women had to live. And in the case of Maya Angelou, this is how black women in America at that time had to live. And it's so extraordinary to just compare and contrast, to go back. So we're going to do this four times a year to give people time to read. That's what I wanted to say. Susie, what did you come to say that you didn't get to say?
Oh, okay, I've got one thing I want to say is that my big, big dream in life is that this book is something that you can press into the hand of people that you love and give it to women you know, give it to your daughters, give it to your best friend, like, and just have this secret society of women that have read it. And one of the things I learned from the play was that so many people come up to me now and say, I'm one in three. And that was really profound for me. And in a way, the book actually, the ending of the book is inspired by that notion. So there's people that you all know that are one in three, if not yourself. And I feel like spread the word. I think Women United can never be defeated. I really do believe that if we unite, and the patriarchy does the best thing of dividing us. So let's just fight that, really.
I got chills hearing that, that I really, really did. Did anyone else? Yeah. Buy the book for everyone you know at Christmas, including, some people are going, is it a Christmas present?
Easter. Yeah. Easter.
It's also so it's far
birthdays,
away.
Easter, and what an Easter gift. It's Easter Bunny. Easter Bunny's brought you this very well written, but at times highly disturbing book. But it's got, listen, it's a hopeful ending. I wanted an egg. No. Sorry, Davey.
Sellotape a packet of mini eggs to it.
Yeah, but if there's teenage boys in your life, boys in their, or young men,
yes.
Really, really useful for them to read it too. It's not just a book for women.
Definitely not.
And anyone in the legal profession, apparently it's compulsory, so sit and watch them read it. You are our first book club. You're the only people. Look, I'll be honest with you, we're shadow banned because we've been posting political content. Something that would get 2,000 likes is getting under 100 at the moment. Everyone's complaining about it. Jamila Jamil's done a big campaign about it. We're trying to get unshadow banned. I'm talking to someone whose husband was one of the founders of Facebook.
I'm going to explain what
that is. Oh, it means that people can't see your Instagram posts, and it's a real problem at the moment. Whoa. So I'm trying to do other ways that aren't just, oh, pop it on socials, because it's not, that's at the moment, it's not working. And not everyone listens to every episode of the podcast. People are 6 weeks behind. You know, there's all sorts you'll miss out on. So I'm going back to email because I don't trust any of these fuckers anymore. All these fuckerbergs are just, I don't know what they're on, but they are all fucking, I mean, Twitter was a reliable cesspit, but now it's just like any day now, Elon Musk could throw all his toys out of the pram and say, I'm taking it to space. I don't know. I only trust email now. So if you could write your email address down, we won't spam you, but we'll let you know if there's another book club. We'll tell you, buy these books or through, obviously buy them at Waterstones, please, because they're doing this collaboration with us. Oh, I've got a book out that's coming out in April 2025. It's called Six Conversations We're Scared to Have, and it's about why conversations are becoming so polarized and what we can do about it, but from a progressive lens. It's not just, cancel culture's gone mad. It's, okay, here's a problem, let's try and solve it. It may be the book that gets me cancelled, so enjoy me between now and April while you're still allowed. Thank you very much. Thank you, big thank you to everyone at Waterstones. Huge thank you to Eliana Ostro, Jessica Foster-Q, and the wonderful Susie Miller. I've been Deborah Francis-White. We've been the Guilty Feminist Waterstones Book Club. Good night. You have been listening to the Guilty Feminist with me, Deborah Francis-White, guest co-host Jessica Foster-Q, and our very special guests, Eliana Ostro and Susie Miller. The recording engineer was Grundy-Liz Impera. Music was by Mark Koch. The producer was Tom Silinski for The Spontaneity Shop. Thanks to Rachel Craftsman, Gina Dicio, Zainab Mahal, and everyone at Waterstones, as well as all of you for listening. For more information about this and other episodes, visit guiltyfeminist.com. I'm a feminist, but my favourite famous five... My favourite famous... Oh, my God. I haven't had a drink.
The Guilty Feminist is provided exclusively from Acast. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.